Parkinson, and the title of his talk is If You Know These Things, Dot, Dot, Dot. If You Know These Things. Brother Jim.
I think you all can fill in the dot, dot, dot. But when you do, especially stress the word if. If ye know these things, blessed are ye if ye do them. Pardon me. Now, if we do not do these things, there's no blessing promised. But also, if we do not know them, how can we do them? Excuse me. You're nobody to be sneezed at. What we believe should influence the way I determine to develop my Christian character. I thank David Rice for putting these slides together. There are just a few of them. What we will notice is that in the number of things that we believe, we should do so because we find them in the Word of God, and those things harmonize all of the Scriptures, not even all but one or two. And among these things we find the ransom sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the development of the church through the gospel age, the sacrificing part of the priesthood, with the priesthood doing the blessing in the age to come, the restitution of all things, the resurrection of the dead, and the restoration to perfection. But we also have some prophetic things. And pertinent to the age in which we live, it's what's going on. It's a chaotic world. You don't need to tell other people that. They will tell you. At the same time, there is something constructive going on in this world. And it's good to keep our concentration, our focus on what is being built up. The restoration of Israel began about 135 years ago, and the things that led up to it just a little before that. So we'll take a look and see just what are the major world events that we have seen in our lifetime and the lifetime of our fathers and grandfathers. First, going back to 1873, there was the Long Depression. And by long, it continued into the 1890s in some places. Following that, the next major world event was World War I, then the Great Depression, World War II, and then the East versus West conflict. You know, it's called state socialism if you lived in the East, and it's called communism if you lived in the West. I will suggest that what seems to me to be the case from the Scriptures, we're on the threshold of a deep depression, and that will come before Armageddon, and that these seven events will divide up the harvest period. Just very briefly, because we've been through it before a number of times, when Joshua was at Jericho, the first day begins with, "And Joshua rose early." That the gospel age began with the resurrection of Joshua, whose Greek name is Jesus. And then there are 7 days until Jericho falls. And the beginning of the last day, the seventh day, and they rose early, like the resurrection of the sleeping saints. And then they marched 7 times around the city until the fall of the wall of Jericho, the fall of Babylon, Armageddon, the end of this present evil world, setting a stage for the millennial resurrection kingdom. Now, if we take a look at these major world events, they seem to have contributed an awful lot of chaos in this world. But for Israel, it has been a good thing. The long depression in month of May that the stock market collapsed there, and about 4 months later it collapsed in New York for it to start the long depression. What happened then was the Christian revolt. What caused it or contributed to it? The fall planting of 1874 in the Balkan Peninsula resulted in a disastrously poor harvest in the spring of 1875. And the Ottomans overtaxed the non-Muslims, the farmers especially, several times what the Muslims were paid, were taxed. And that sparked the Christian revolt, and you can read more about that online and so forth. And from there, things fell like dominoes. The Ottoman Empire declared bankruptcy in October of that year, and there was a revolt here, and then these nations declared war on the Ottoman Empire, and then those nations did, and so forth. Ultimately, it resulted in the Treaty of San Stefano, which essentially handed over the Balkans to the Russians, and that wasn't satisfactory to the rest of Europe. And so they had a Congress of Nations in Berlin in the middle of the year. And at that Congress, the first and only Jewish Prime Minister of England could point out to the Porte of the Ottoman Empire, "Look, you're broke. You need money. You got this no good land over in Palestine. Go ahead and sell it. We'll find you buyers for it." And they did. So in October of 1878, the Jews began returning to the land at Petah Tikva. And then in November, it was another, went into approximately a new community every month from then on. That was the beginning, a new beginning for Israel, the first sign of a beginning of something that would lead to the kingdom of Christ. World War I contributed the Balfour Declaration, setting aside Palestine as a homeland specifically for the Jews. Not just anybody, but specifically for the Jews. Along came the Great Depression. Then the Jews fled from the Nazis to Palestine. And during World War II, the Nazi influence was extended through Central and Western Europe, driving still more back. We had the East versus West struggle, and at the end, the Jews began fleeing from the East to Israel. In fact, actually, even before the end, before World War II, there were a bit over 3 million Jews in Poland. Today, I think it is fewer than 25,000 left. And the chief beneficiary has not been the United States, but Israel. Already 1 million have gone back from the Soviet disunion. Then, if the next major world event is a deep depression, the last major concentration of Jews in the world today is in the Americas, particularly the United States, Canada, and Argentina. If they come back from the Americas, then the chief concentration of Jews will be in Israel. At that point, the significance of Armageddon will be that Israel's enemies will come against the land and its surrounding neighbors, if we understand Ezekiel 38 and 9 correctly, but they will succeed in destroying one another. So for all the chaos that has been going on for 140 years, there is one positive aspect to it. Every major world event has contributed one major step towards the restoration of Israel. That's positive. Now then, the same major world event has been detrimental to Babylon, to the kingdom of this world. And if we look at the ecclesiastical side, we can see something systematic about that. the Long Depression also saw the call, "Come out of Babylon, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins." Let's make that reason be number one, and that you receive not of her plagues. That's from Revelation 18, verses 1 through 5 in particular. We come to World War I. Well, they lost the king's supports because they lost the king's. In the Great Depression, that was the fall of fundamentalism. Now, the basics of fundamentalism weren't bad. They were good. The five major issues that they picked at the very beginning were the inspiration of the Bible. It's the only standard of faith and truth, just as it remains to this day. The second was the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. The third was that he was a sacrificial atonement, a substitutionary atonement for sin. The fourth was concerning the genuineness of his resurrection. And the fifth, the certainty of his return. Unfortunately, what often went with it was a Protestant tradition, which differed from denomination to denomination or group to group. So as fundamentalism fell, it was sort of relegated to the very fringes of Protestant thought. Most of the theological schools and seminaries were under the control of the liberals, who preached the idea of mankind is evolving into a great society and has no more need of old technology and old things like the Bible. Along came World War II. That war to end all wars? Couldn't explain that. And liberalism as such fell. Another time we can talk about what it was replaced with. During the East versus West struggle, it was the fall of Catholic tradition. Now, Catholicism claims to be built equally on Scripture and tradition. We read the Scriptures, and for decades, the tradition was being swept clean out from under the Catholic Church. If there's a deep depression, well, remember, ecclesiasticism has still two things going for it: great wealth and vast numbers of people. The deep depression would take care of the great wealth because of bankruptcy. And Armageddon, the people revolt. Now, that's on the downside. Again, we can go through it and we see what happens. In the Long Depression, as it affects us, well, Bible students teach not so much the end of the world as the consummation of the age. You don't have a harvest simply to burn off or the whole field without getting something first. You want to get the crop harvested. That's a consummation of the age. You get something out of it before having the field burned over, ready to start fresh. Now, some of the teaching was, we expect something to happen in 1914. Just as a little bit of an aside, when the Brethren had conventions in the middle of 1914 in Clinton, Iowa, Columbus, Ohio, Asbury Park, New Jersey, there were about three that spoke up about October in 1914, what they would expect. And they were all certain that it was going to come and end everything. Church going to be taken up or whatever. And those that were at Columbus, Ohio, like Brother George Raymond, former fist-pounding Baptist preacher, was saying, "You've been hearing how many years it would be and how many months and how many days and how many gasps of breath. You haven't heard much about that at this convention, have you?" And he went on to say, "Do not count on 1914. And he was saying, "You know, it could be 1914, or it could be 1915, or 1920.
You can see that in your towers. What? You say? He said that? Why, absolutely. You've been keeping your nose in the second volume and not reading the May 1st tower. That's where to get the up-to-date information.
In fact, there was just one voice that I could see in those conventions that was quite willing to have it either way. That was Brother Russell. I didn't mean to spend so much time on that, but it's interesting. We come to the Great Depression, and now, after Brother Russell died, the call continued. Come out of Babylon number two, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins. And then we come to World War II. Both Jews and Bible students were imprisoned in Germany and elsewhere in more or less Central Europe. During the East versus West conflict, the harvest message began going worldwide once again. During the Deep Depression, will it spike the rise of Islam? Well, if we understand Ezekiel 38 correctly, Sheba and Dedan will be at the head of the Western Bloc. That Westernmost Europe and its former colonies are under Tarshish and the merchants of Tarshish and all the young lions thereof. And that suggests then that Armageddon will be a battle of the atheistic East versus the Islamic-led West. If so, though, there's one consolation prize in that. They won't be able to blame Christ for Armageddon. Well now, we've come through looking at the major world events from three different standpoints. Which one should we focus on? I suggest that it is better for our Christian characters to focus on the return of Israel to their land. That's the preparation for the new age, the kingdom, the resurrection kingdom. We can tell our friends, whether in the denominations or otherwise, that God has given us a concrete pledge that He will establish His kingdom, keep watching the return of Israel. Already, over 40% of world Jewry is back in the land, and it is still growing. Now then, this world is committing suicide. Jeremiah saw Judah committing national suicide in his day. He told them why it is happening. Today, let us do likewise. Question. Are you and I in training for what we are going to do after Armageddon? On how to help a devastated people? Okay, let's think how this knowledge should influence our lives, how we conduct our lives. If everyone you meet is a probable convert in the thousand-year kingdom of Christ, how should we now act towards each one? You know, even that one who's cantankerous or downright obnoxious, even that one is a candidate for conversion in the millennial kingdom of Christ. Now, will they later learn better from what we have said or from the way that we have behaved? Does the way we behave underscore our words? Will a person learn better how to change his character from remembering how you or I changed our characters? Can you and I show them how it's done? If you see a good example, follow it. If you do not see a good example, then set the good example. That's how people learn best, don't we? Just a little selection from Edgar Guest, a sermon scene. I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one should walk with me than merely tell the way. And the lecture you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. Now, how can I help someone in the resurrection to learn to be merciful? To be merciful to the one who offended him in the Adamic age. How? By me now showing mercy even to the ungrateful. We can see what our Lord had to say in Matthew 6. The Lord's Prayer, and just after. Do we hate those who do horrible things to others? We are to hate what they do, but not the terrorist, anarchist, swindler, liar, etc. You know, it's going to be hard enough on them in the resurrection kingdom. How about temper? Temperamental is about 90% temper and less than 10% mental. Temper is a bad thing. It's bad to have a temper, and it's worse to lose it. So we got to get rid of it. Now there's another thing, and that is sometimes we need to be prepared for surprises. Sometimes those surprises will be pleasant, sometimes not so pleasant. It was just a few years ago, I was thinking about the fig tree and how Jesus cursed the fig tree when he came and found no figs on it. And it says that it wasn't the season for figs. So, was Jesus temperamental? Hot-headed? I was reading something from F.F. Bruce, Frederick Fivey Bruce, a Scotsman. And he says, the fig tree produces a little tiny nubbin before it produces the fig. And these nubbins drop off, but they're edible. So, when it says that Jesus came to the fig tree and found no figs to eat, oh, it would be these little nubbins, or tekash, they call them. And if the tekash was not there, then it wasn't going to produce any figs when it was time for the figs. Well, that's nice. It assures us that Jesus wasn't temperamental or losing it. But sometimes what I get is a bit of a jolt. I'll suggest about two of them. One of them is in Matthew 5:32. That's part of the Sermon on the Mount. And someone about 2 years ago sent me a scholarly paper on that someone ignores the translation, ignores the tense of the verb. And practically every translation you will look at ignores the tense of the verb. There's a past tense there where it's translated as a present tense. And I will omit a clause temporarily in quoting it, that whoso puts away his wife causes her to have committed adultery. Well, wait a minute. He can't. How can he do it retroactively? She wasn't an adulteress, and then divorces her, and now she has been an adulteress in the past? Well, a Greek reading it, an Englishman reading it, can't get the idea. A Hebrew reading it would have a much better opportunity. He will understand that whosoever divorces his wife causes her to be deemed to have committed adultery. The suspicion is created. Now, the clause I dropped out was except for the case of fornication. Well, if there's been fornication involved, then obviously that's the only reason she's guilty. But if she's perfectly innocent, the man divorcing her will cause suspicion to fall upon her, and it's his fault. Now then, there's another set of scriptures. I was reading in the marriage chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And there's three different cases considered. The first case, I think it starts about verses 10 and 11 maybe. A case of a believer is married to another believer. And then start with verse 12, and it's a different situation, that it's a believer married to an unbeliever. But then there's a third case considered, and that is when we get to verses 25 to 28. And it starts out by saying, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord. You read down through those four verses, and you get the idea, the sense of the question that has been asked of Paul. Evidently, a divorced man is saying, is it proper for me to marry a virgin? And so Paul says, okay, I'm going to give my best advice. And I think that if a man is bound to a wife, then don't seek to be loosed. If you're loosed from a wife, then don't seek a wife. But if thou marriest, thou hast not sinned. Interesting. And if a virgin marry him, she has not sinned. That caught my attention, all right. But then I went back to the beginning, and here he says, but I have no commandment from the Lord. And my first reaction to that was, how can he say that? Doesn't he know about Matthew 19? Or how about Mark 10? And when I calmed down a bit, I felt more like, oh no, just when I knew everything, this had to come along. But then I got to thinking, I've got to find the resolution, if I can, the harmony between the scriptures in Corinthians 7 and what Jesus said. And what Jesus said was, whosoever divorces his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery. Well, for some years, I wasn't quite sure for what it really meant. Does he say that whosoever divorces his wife and ever marries another committeth adultery? Or does he mean that whosoever divorces his wife in order to marry another committeth adultery, because he can't marry two of them without being a bigamist? And it could be now that Paul is answering that question by saying, here I have no commandment from the Lord. It would seem that he is saying here whosoever divorces his wife in order to marry another commits adultery. It doesn't say what it is to be 20 or 30 years later. And if so, that really seems to make pretty good sense. What he's saying is, if you're eyeing another woman, and you figure, well, I'm not allowed to commit bigamy, so I got to divorce the first one first. I'll trade in the old one on a new model. I think we sort of naturally realize that that is just unacceptable conduct. And Paul is underscoring that as well as Jesus is underscoring it to begin with. And I must admit, those two scriptures together came as a real shock. That seems to be what it's saying. Now, if someone finds that there's some other way to resolve it without adding to what Jesus is saying or what Paul is saying, I'd be glad to hear about it. But this, to me, was one of the real shocks that I have had in the last few years, to realize that, no, I don't know everything. And when I stop learning, it will be time to give me a granite headboard. Now, do you feel insecure today? Most people do. The fallen nature says, if I feel insecure, the way I can overcome that is by controlling others. But it is those who control self least who most demand to control others. One sees it in the political world, but also in the religious world. Do I want to be in charge of everything? Bad news. If I'm in charge, then the Lord isn't. We need to learn self-control. Some will say, I am unhappy. And in essence, say after that, we need to change. We need to change everybody else. No, happiness or sadness is controlled by the self. 1 Timothy 1:7, I think it is, it says that God has not given us the spirit of fear. If we have the spirit of fear, the spirit of the Lord is not there. Perfect love casteth out fear. And this is a world that is governed by fear. Or how can I recognize a guilt complex in myself? Do I often try to hang a guilt trip on others? Do I find myself often blaming others for whatever is wrong? If I have wronged someone, let me attempt restitution for it. And then have faith in God. You know, when you consider how difficult it is to change yourself, you know what your chances are of changing anybody else. So, let's change ourselves and show the world how it is done. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Now, I have one other topic to address. That's punctuality.
Thank you, Brother Jim, for those thoughts. And if you know these things, thank you.